From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. The past decade in baseball has been very, very good for fans, with record-breaking performances and packed stadiums. But growing evidence of widespread steroid use has tainted records, damaged reputations, and provoked congressional hearings on the dark side of the game. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with sports writer Howard Bryant. His new book is called Juicing the Game. Also behind the scenes in the White House press room with veteran reporter Helen Thomas. She's covered every president since John Kennedy. And rock critic Ken Tucker brings us the music of the band Dr. Dog. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. A lot of baseball fans who marveled at Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire's race to break the Major League home run record in 1998 held lingering suspicions that baseball's power surge was really driven by steroids. Over the past 2 years, any illusions about baseball's home run binge have been swept away by player confessions, a federal investigation, and eventually congressional hearings into steroid use. My guest Howard Bryant reconstructs baseball's tainted decade in his new book, Juicing the Game: Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. Bryant says signs were clear for years that players were bulking up on chemical additives, and those running the game were too busy making money to worry about it. Bryant is a sports columnist for the Boston Herald and the author of an earlier book, Shut Out, A History of Race and Baseball in Boston. Well, Howard Bryant, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I remember in 1996 when all of a sudden this outfielder on the Baltimore Orioles, Brady Anderson, who'd been had a history as a singles hitter, suddenly was just blasting balls out of the ballpark, leading the majors, I think, in home runs. And I think a lot of people began to wonder if something different was happening with the game. Give us a sense of how striking the explosion of power hitting was in the 90s.
Well, I think the best way to describe it from today's perspective, from a 2005 perspective, is when you look back at the years 1995 to 2002, you had home runs that were being hit at a level unseen in the history of baseball. You had players hitting home runs. It used to be, for any baseball fan, a real accomplishment, a real Everest-like accomplishment to hit 50 home runs. And in 1995, starting with Albert Bell and moving all the way to 2002 with Alex Rodriguez, the player for the New York Yankees now, but he was with Texas at the time, you had someone hit at least 50 home runs in every season during those years, which had never been accomplished in baseball history before. You had one player, Sammy Sosa, hit 60 home runs three times. Babe Ruth never did that. Hank Aaron never did that. Willie Mays had never done that. And what was more amazing during this period was that not only did Sammy Sosa hit 60 home runs in three different seasons, but in none of those years did he win a home run title.
Came up short with 60. Wow. We've known about steroids and performance-enhancing drugs for years in the Olympics, and that was believed to be used in pro football. But for a long time, there was this sense that the kind of skills that baseball required really were not likely to be improved by steroids, right? I mean, it was thought to be a different kind of game.
Exactly, and the question had always been in baseball. It wasn't really a question. It was almost something more of a declaration. These drugs may help you run fast. These drugs may help you lift more weights. These drugs may help you be stronger. They may give you greater athletic. They may enhance your athletic gifts, but they won't help you be a good baseball player. Now, this is incongruous on its face. And in fact, in light of what we know today, it's ridiculous. But this was the argument that had been pushed forward by baseball players, by executives, by media, by so many very influential entities, that it became fact.
I wonder if for many years some baseball players maybe didn't take them because there was a belief that it was a different kind of thing, that bulk would make you less flexible. Hank Aaron, hit all those, the all-time home run leader. Well, was not a bulky guy.
Well, no, and it's a great point, because what I found so fascinating in the book, and one of my favorite parts of the book, was recognizing that within 5 years, between I'd say 1988, 89, and 1994, 150 years of conventional wisdom in baseball went out the window, that lifting weights couldn't help you, that you were going to be too big, too bulky, too muscle-bound to swing at the baseball. And in fact, in the old days, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, players who lifted weights were not only ridiculed, but they were often fined by their teams.
Wow.
For conduct detrimental to the ball club, that they weren't helping themselves. If you talk to Joe Torre, the manager of the Yankees, he'll tell you that you were never supposed to lift weights. It was one of the biggest no-nos in baseball. You were not supposed to do it. By 1988, with Jose Canseco and the Oakland A's and Mark McGwire and these huge muscle-bound players, that you had old-timers looking at this team and it looked like a football team. They had never seen baseball players so big. And within 5 years of that, not only did you have baseball players lifting weights before and after games, which was unprecedented, but you had entire teams that were buying nutritional supplements and buying these protein shakes and enhancing their weight rooms all over baseball.
You know, a lot of attention has focused on superstars who are believed to have used steroids and set records. But I imagine that, you know, there are lots and lots of baseball players who the public don't know who've spent years at the margins of the game, in and out of the minor leagues, trying to get their shot at the majors. And I'm wondering, is there evidence to believe that those folks were using, I mean, the mediocre player or almost good enough players were using steroids to give them that jump and help them make it to the big leagues?
Those are the players that were probably using the steroids even more. This is an economic story. The minimum salary in Major League Baseball is $300,000. Just to get there, once you become a Major League player, that is your salary. When you're not a Major League player, your salary is between $800 and $1,000 per month. So you can see the difference between being a minor league player and being a Major League player. And what began to happen in baseball during this decade was a feeling among these players, not the great players. Barry Bonds with anabolic steroids, Barry Bonds without anabolic steroids, is still one of the greatest baseball players you've ever seen. The real story happened on the margins with these players who were on the fringe, and they began to tell themselves, I have to use these drugs in order to compete with the guy next to me. I may be completely opposed to this. I may know that it's dangerous for me. I may know that one day it may possibly kill me or hurt future generations of my children. But I need to do this because it's the only way that I'll be able to compete at the major league level and receive that big contract.
Did you get to know minor league players that were in this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I remember, in fact, one of my favorite players was a young man named A.J. Hinch, who was a catcher with the Oakland A's in 1998. And A.J. told me when I was researching this book that he had a conversation with his wife one day, and he told her that I'm going to make a decision that's going to affect this family. I am not going to use these drugs, even though I'm convinced that if I do, I'm just good enough that I could get one of those three-year, $10 million contracts, and this family would be set for life. And those types of conversations have been going on throughout baseball during this decade, because what began to happen was players began to look at each other, and they began to wonder who was competing on the level, who was not, and what did I have to do to compete with those players who weren't.
In the 90s, what was Major League Baseball's drug testing policy, if any?
Baseball did not have a drug testing policy in the 1990s. It wasn't until 2002 that baseball had finally decided that it could negotiate a comprehensive drug testing agreement with its players' association. And what I found very interesting about that was the motivation for this. When I listened to the various people that I interviewed for the book, the commissioner and a lot of his associates and the owners of the game and the players and everybody, we were always told that baseball did not have a drug problem. Then you realize in 2000 there was a key meeting between the commissioner and a lot of his medical officials, the team doctors and trainers from other teams. And that was in December of 2000. And they went around the room and the commissioner asked them, you know, from a health standpoint and from the standpoint of the tools that you need to do your jobs. What's the most important thing that you're being faced with? And almost to a man, they told the commissioner that the rising use of supplements, anabolic steroids, human growth hormone was the number one problem that was facing them. And that was the commissioner's epiphany. That was his moment. And not long after that, the vice president for labor relations, Rob Manfred, testified in front of Congress, I think in June of 2002, and said some very remarkable things that never received any type of public play, but it really spoke to what was happening in the game. Manfred testified to Congress that baseball statistically had seen a rise of injuries, had seen great baseball players, these very expensive players, staying on the disabled list even longer, that the baseball owners were costing themselves millions and millions of dollars by having these $10, $15 million ball players on the disabled list by being injured all of this time. And that, to them, when their doctors had analyzed this data, suggested a rising use of steroids and supplements.
And why did prolonged use of steroids increase the risk of injuries to these players?
Well, because what these drugs do, especially when players become fanatic about weightlifting, is that in the case of very big players, that you begin to gain so much muscle mass that your body becomes too big for your frame, that your joints don't grow, your joints don't necessarily get stronger, and you begin to have muscle and tendon injuries. Dr. James Andrews, who's probably the most famous doctor in baseball who works on players, said that during the five-year period, during 1 5-year period in the 90s, I believe it was from 1997 to 02, he had never seen as many muscle tendon injuries during that period as in his 35 years in baseball.
My guest is Howard Bryant. He is a columnist for the Boston Herald. His new book is called Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Boston Herald columnist Howard Bryant. His new book about the steroid scandal in baseball is Juicing the Game. One of the interesting aspects of this struggle was that the Baseball Players Union, the Major League Players Association, strongly resisted a tough drug testing policy. And a lot of people would look at that and say, well, wouldn't the players want fairness? I mean, why would they want to permit a situation in which some players are allowed to cheat?
Well, you had a couple of them. There are a couple of questions there. And the first one is that you had a players' association that was never quite convinced that steroids were the scourge that everyone believed them to be. There had never been any type of real study across the board to satisfy the union about what steroids actually did or did not do for baseball players. Even the people that I profile in the book, and I call them the Crusaders, who are the medical experts who continued to hammer down on these professional sports leagues to take this drug question seriously as a health crisis. Even they were totally and completely conflicted with each other about the long-term and short-term effects of anabolic steroids. So on the one hand, you had baseball people saying, until we know, why would we create policy? Now, to their detractors, this was a straw argument to simply not deal with the issue. Inside the game, you had players who could not agree, they could not come to any consensus on what to do with the steroid question. You had some players who said, yes, this is cheating, this is wrong, you can make $10 million a year and I can't because you're using these substances. This is not right. We all have to be playing under the same umbrella. Then you had other players who said, well, I don't want the baseball owners to test me for anything. There's no other employee in the country that gets drug tested for anabolic steroids or blood tested at all in this nation. So why should we be set under a different segment of rules? And that's where the 2002 agreement became so historic in one sense, because no one had ever believed that the players would agree to any type of testing at all, because it all came down to one thing, and it was the historic vitriol between the owners and the players. They could not come to an agreement, and at the same time, everybody in the game at some level had compromised their own integrity by not dealing with this as quickly as they needed to.
In 2002, when there was clearly evidence of steroid abuse, baseball was approaching another collective bargaining agreement. The players and the owners did agree on a drug testing regimen of sorts. Was it a serious effort? Was it likely to be effective?
Well, if you talk to the commissioner, he'll tell you that this was a passion of his, that he had decided that he was willing to allow the players to go on strike again in 2002 if they did not agree to a comprehensive drug policy. That was remarkable in of itself because of where baseball was in 1994. I think it was widely agreed upon that baseball could not afford another strike. When the agreement is ratified in 2002 in August and the players do agree to drug testing, it was so completely unsatisfying to everyone across the board because of the politics involved that the drug testing policy was widely ridiculed across the country, where a player had to test positive five times before there was any real sanction, that players were allowed to take their drug tests without supervision to some degree, that players were able to essentially time when the drug test would, when they would be tested. And so it was laughable. And it was a very, very much a disappointment and a defeat for the commissioner, because his position was, we finally got something and let's build upon this. And the reaction, especially from the Olympic community, was, you've got to be kidding. You call this a drug policy? And so you begin to have the bullseye being placed upon baseball.
Well, Howard Bryant, I mean, the steroid issue really blew up in 2004 with a whole series of revelations, beginning with this, essentially was a tax investigation of a San Francisco nutritional lab. That led us to information about the great Barry Bonds taking steroids and all kinds of other things. This really kind of snowballed, didn't it?
It was the culmination of all of the different things that we had been told over the years that weren't true. We had been told that there was that drugs couldn't help you. We were told all of these different things that players weren't using. We were told that players were being persecuted unfairly by the press and by anybody else. And now all of a sudden, what you really have here is you have the players who came out and essentially outed themselves. In 2002, you had Ken Caminiti and Jose Canseco both say that almost half the league was using steroids. You had David Wells in 2003 with his book come out and say that 40% of players were using, and then he was pressured to reduce it to 20%. And now you have Balco. And with Balco, now you've raised the level of play here between, first it was a question of who was using steroids and who wasn't. Now you've got a legal story here. And now you've got the federal government involved. And once the federal government got involved, that's where you began to see the parallels to the 1919 Black Sox. That's where people began to really look at this story and say, this is something historic. And what you found was this ball of string just begin to unravel. And there was nowhere for baseball to go anymore because all of its contradictions were now being exposed by this federal government investigation that revealed that the best players in the game were using these very substances that they had always told us could not help them.
Boston Herald sports columnist Howard Bryant. His new book is Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. He'll be back in the second half of the show. And since we spoke, there's been this development in the Balco Lab steroid investigation. Victor Conti, the central figure in the probe, has pled guilty to distributing steroids, but will not cooperate with investigators or name players he might have supplied. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for NPR comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, it's gotten ugly in the White House press room in the wake of the Karl Rove controversy. We'll talk with Helen Thomas, who's covered every president since John Kennedy. Also, more on baseball with sports writer Howard Bryant, and we'll listen to the music of Dr. Dog. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're talking about baseball steroid scandal with Boston Herald sports columnist Howard Bryant. His new book is Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. Now, when the House Government Reform Committee decided that they were angry and were going to bring some of baseball's executives, its union leaders, and some of its big stars before the nation in congressional hearings, how did baseball executives and the players react initially when asked to appear?
Well, the baseball executives tried to compare being subpoenaed about steroid use to Iran-Contra. They were outraged. They believed that their civil liberties were being violated. The baseball players, after years of being pampered and years of of being able to intimidate their way out of any serious situation. They laughed at this. They didn't believe that the Congress had any type of authority whatsoever over them, that they were untouchable. And when it became clear that the subpoenas came out, and when it became clear that this was real, that scene on March 17th was unbelievable. It was surreal, from having these players testify under oath. It was remarkable from the standpoint of just the savagery of baseball, of the congressional leaders, how upset they were. What we saw that day was the reduction of baseball as a untouchable entity, that all of a sudden you had these great baseball players who, I think I put it in my book, were scared little boys, Curt Schilling and Rafael Palmeiro and Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire, who disgraced himself, because now there was nowhere to go. And you had these players forced to recognize their contradictions, and not just their contradictions, but their transgressions, because they were under oath. And they were very clear about what they could now say and what they couldn't.
Let's just take one piece of that. Describe Mark McGwire's appearance.
Mark McGwire's role as an American icon was destroyed that day. I was sitting very, very close to him. And here is a man who hit 583 home runs. There's a highway named after him in St. Louis. And he was so ridiculed by not answering questions, by refusing to even offer even the slightest bit of insight into his career, that every time he answered with the same response, "I'm not here to talk about the past," people in the gallery were giggling. During a congressional committee on national television, he had disgraced himself. And what really struck me about this was afterwards, people had asked whether or not Mark McGwire should be immortalized as a Hall of Famer. And I said to myself, if he wouldn't, on national television, under oath, speaking to his country, if he would not defend his career, why should anyone else? And I thought it was one of the saddest moments that I had ever witnessed of the day, and it said a lot about this decade. I think it was the defining moment of the decade.
Well, Howard Bryant, I mean, baseball clearly has suffered a terrible embarrassment with all this exposure. What's actually changed in the game in terms of testing, steroid use, and home run production?
Well, I think players have had enough, and I think the owners have had enough. I think that the commissioner knows that it's time to put an end to this. And the thing that we do know is that since 2002, at the end of the 2002 season, to me, that was perhaps the end of the steroid era, from the standpoint that not only do you no longer have 50 home run seasons, but you haven't had a 60 home run season, certainly not a 70 home run season. You see production, you see home run numbers in the aggregate going up, but the individual players who were accomplishing these remarkable feats, those numbers have gone back to normal. They've gone in the other direction. That suddenly the game is beginning to balance itself out. I don't think it's just a coincidence that, gee, with drug testing, suddenly you've had a reduction of these individual numbers. I said to the commissioner, I believe you have two problems here. The first is there a mechanism in place to allow this game to move forward? And I believe that there is, because I do think that this drug testing and all of this exposure and Congress being involved, I think finally we do have some clarity on this. But the second question is, what are we moving forward from? And the commissioner still does not believe that an investigation of this decade is appropriate. And he has that right. But I do think that until we begin to look at it a little bit more, there will always be that question. And you look at the players. What do you say to those players who played during this era that were clean? Who looked out for them? They didn't look out for themselves. The game didn't look out for them. And now you, forever, when they look at the decade that they played in, it will always be under the cloud of steroids.
Well, Howard Bryant, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Howard Bryant's new book is Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. Coming up inside the White House press room during the Karl Rove controversy with veteran reporter Helen Thomas. This is Fresh Air. The atmosphere in the White House press room has gotten testy lately as more information emerges about White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove's possible involvement in leaking the name of CIA agent Valerie Plame to reporters. Press Secretary Scott McClellan has faced hostile questioning in his recent briefings. One reporter long accustomed to aggressively interrogating government officials is Helen Thomas, often referred to as the First Lady of the White House press corps. Here she is in action last week with McClellan.
We're on the verge of accomplishing some very big things when it comes to the agenda.
But is Karl Rove an impediment now with all this attention distracting from that push on your agenda?
Everybody who is working here is helping us to advance the agenda, and that includes Karl in a very big way. So.
Has he apologized to you for telling you he is not involved?
Helen, I'm not going to get into any private discussions.
He put you on the spot. He put your credibility on the line.
And Helen, I appreciate you all wanting to move forward and find the facts relating to this investigation. I want to know all the facts relating to the investigation.
People are on the record.
The president wants to get to the bottom
another.
Of it, and it's just not appropriate. If you'll remember back 2 years ago,
Helen Thomas has covered every president since John Kennedy, most of them for United Press International. She's now a syndicated columnist for Hearst Newspapers and is the author of three books. We decided to get her perspective on the Rove affair and the Bush administration's handling of the Washington media. Recently, when the White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan and the administration changed their position on commenting about this matter, from having originally said it was ridiculous to suggest Karl Rove was involved, to its current position, which is that we don't comment on an ongoing investigation. I mean, the White House press corps responded in those briefings with scathing, mocking barbs, really.
It's about time.
Give us a sense of what it was like to be in that room then.
Well, it was, suddenly they came out of their coma. The White House press corps, and I'm a member, and I've been there 40 years, and all I can say is they let the country down in the run-up to the Iraqi war, and I was very pleased that they finally took the bait and understood. You just don't give up your weapon of skepticism ever. And so it was so blatant after 2 years and insisting there was no involvement on the part of the White House or the White House officials, especially Karl Rove, and then to come up, I can't talk about this anymore, but you did talk about it.
You've been raising some tough questions for a while. What counts for the hostility among the rest of the press corps, which usually is not so aggressive, perhaps, in these meetings?
9/11 changed it all. I mean, everyone went mute for fear of being called unpatriotic, un-American, especially for televised briefings. And then when they were finally getting their sea legs, we went into a war and it segued into the war. And so you don't ask questions that jeopardize the troops. I think they really defaulted. I never stopped asking questions that I thought were important because you don't go into war without cause.
You know, a number of critics the comedian Jon Stewart among them joked that when the White House press corps became so aggressive after the change in the position on Karl Rove, I think the joke was that excuses but the White House press corps has been temporarily replaced with real journalists. Is that a fair criticism?
I'm writing a book where I really express my sorrow that the reporters ceased to be reporters in this time of crisis. Look, I know that the onus they're under, or the corporate heads probably don't want them rocking the boat, maybe the American people. But what shocked me is for years and years and years, whenever I asked the president a tough question, I would get these phone calls. How dare you? You, who elected you? Why did you ask this question? So after the war started, the Iraqi war, I got these calls saying, where is everybody? Why is everyone so mute? Why aren't you asking the questions? So there was a real turnaround. And I think that the press has been criticized rightly for being in a coma.
You know, as more Americans have heard more of the BBC's broadcasts in the United States, some of them have noticed that British reporters seem to really get in the face of their public officials maybe a little bit more than American reporters do. They tend to be, if anything, perhaps overly civil. The president is asked a question, but then his answer is not interrupted, whereas British journalists, it seems, are a little more apt to really get in somebody's grill. Have you noticed that difference?
It's cyclical, really, because reporters were pretty benign in a way, I guess, in the, not really, we've always been tough, but after Watergate, the press room was an arena. It was a lion's den. I mean, we all realized that we had not done our jobs, that we had been had, that everything they said, as according to Ron Ziegler then, was inoperative. Everything that we had passed on to the American people was not so. I mean, this is pretty shocking. So it really was a grand awakening for the press. But 9/11 subdued everyone again, as I say, and they went into this kind of critical mass of they thought they had to be silent and not question the government. I never felt that way. I never do. I think our job is as watchdogs. We should always be questioning.
When you see President Bush on television in news conferences, and he deals with the media, it's striking he often offers little asides or personal gestures of warmth to reporters. Do reporters regard these as genuine, and does it matter?
You mean in terms of smiling or winking?
Yeah. The calling someone by name, the kind of friendly, thank you for bringing that up.
I think that does soften the atmosphere for the reporter he's interested in, but he certainly hates me.
You don't get that, huh?
Get that. I've been shunned. No, it's not bad. Just so someone asks the tough questions, that's what he should get.
Well, let's get into your relationship with this president. I mean, now it has been for decades. Now, tell me if I have this wrong, but I believe you sat in the front, asked the first question at every news conference, and ended the news conference by saying, "Thank you, Mr. President." Right?
Mm-hmm.
What changed?
That's when I worked for UPI, the United Press International. Then I really was privileged. All the wire services, by tradition, going back to Franklin D. Roosevelt, wire services were manning the barricades long before the advent of television. So it was worked out that they would get the first two questions, UPI and Associated Press, and we'd rotate on the first, the other would get the second, and then the senior correspondent would say thank you. Well, I work for Hearst newspapers now, and I didn't deserve to get the first question. And I do still have a front row seat in the press room for the briefings, but press conferences, I find myself in the last row.
Why is that?
Oh, well, because I don't ask nice questions. Anyway, the president comes into these news conferences, so-called, with a preset list of names that he should call on. And I'm not on it.
Never?
Not lately, not for the last year.
What techniques does the president or the press secretary use during a news conference when the questioning is getting intense and they want to, you know, change the subject and derail a tough line of questioning?
This president will take only one question when his answer begs for a follow-up. He limits that and he has a very short fuse. He shows his annoyance. And, you know, we use some sarcasm if he's annoyed on a question. It's very, very controlled. As I say, he has this list. He'll look down and say, now have I asked all the TV people and about it? It's so bizarre. It should be more freewheeling. But, of course, I shouldn't complain because I had the first or second question for years and years and years. And, I can't say that I have been deprived. But I must say that he should take follow-up questions and reporters should stand up and sock it to them. I mean, you can say, Mr. President, you can say thank you, and, if you know, just throw in the sirs if that is helps. But we don't have to worship at anybody's shrine. They're our public servants.
You said earlier that this White House quit calling on you at news conferences. When did you first realize that you were going to be shut down by this administration?
Well, after I put my hand practically up, and the president was at the podium, and I was only like 2 feet away, and I had my hand up to be called on. He totally ignored me for practically a 45-minute news conference, so I got the message then.
Did anyone from the administration ever call you and complain about the way you'd questioned the president?
Well, the first question I ever asked President Bush, he had taken the oath, and 2 weeks later he dropped into our press room, being very nice, went down the line, first row, and I was sitting in the front first row, and every other reporter asked about tax cuts. And I said to him, Mr. President, why don't you respect the wall of separation of church and state? And he looks, there's a video of him where he pulls back. I mean, he was really in a state of shock to be asked such a question, I guess. For some reason, he wasn't prepared for it. He said, I do. I said, well, if you did, you wouldn't have a religious office in the White House. And on it went. And I said, you're really a secular official. I am secular, he said. Anyway, I got a phone call in the afternoon from Ari Fleischer, who was then press secretary. What's the idea of blindsiding the president?
Wow. That's being pretty direct. I guess you knew then things were going to be different.
I got the message.
For many years, most people in the public never saw the raw material of news gathering. They never actually saw a White House press briefing beginning to end. And now, with CNN and C-SPAN, people can actually watch White House reporters, peppering a spokesman with questions for an hour or so. I'm wondering, what effect has televising the whole news conference had on these exchanges?
The White House feels a place to their advantage because we can always be the enfant terrible, the ogres, going after these nice, innocent people who are simply doing the nation's business. So I think that they have thought of it as working to their advantage until they get into a real trouble, real crisis where the American people, then they will say, really, they will begin thinking, why don't they answer these questions? He didn't answer the question. They'll call me up or I'll send email saying, they didn't answer your question. So I think there's been a general awakening and awareness. It's good, really, but this it's all at the behest of, well, of course, the television networks want the TV. And they want the picture. It's not a story without a picture, right?
Right.
But print reporters, per se, did not want this because we really wanted to be able to question without having it judged. And at the same time, it did give us instant recognition.
What's the press room like? Is it a nice facility?
Well, it was when it started out, but, you know, when you bring in 50 cameras and drag in all the maintenance and then it's gotten pretty crummy, but nothing can replace being there. They would be very happy to put us in a lovely building with marble floors if we would just get out. But no, you have to be inside the White House, and that's a great sign of democracy, too. It's our house. Every president I've ever covered said, this house, meaning the White House, belongs to the American people. So when they really start pushing me around, I say, hey, I thought this was my house, too.
Well, Helen Thomas, I know you're very busy. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
You're welcome.
Helen Thomas is a syndicated columnist for Hearst Newspapers. Coming up, Ken Tucker brings us the music of Dr. Dog. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Dog is a quintet of 20-somethings from the suburbs of Philadelphia with three albums they cut in their home studio. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the band's intentionally ragged sound and aimless-sounding lyrics defy easy comparison to other rock groups, and they work both for and against the band.
We live in a time of consumer guide pop culture. Millions of people want to know what's hot, what's good, what they should plunk down their hard-earned cash for. When it comes to music, the easiest way for music critics to perform consumer service is to play the comparison game. Band X sounds like Y crossed with Z. The Streetcars Named Desire, a band I just made up for this example, sounds like Tom Waits on a bender with Sleater-Kinney if their drummer was Ginger Baker. The idea is to come up with a useful shorthand. But it's also very bad music criticism, and ultimately just encourages musicians to sound like other musicians. You cannot play this game with Dr. Dog, because to the best of my knowledge, Dr. Dog rarely sound like anyone else.
I recall the moment, though I can't recall the day, every hour.
The five guys in Dr. Dog are hardworking goofballs. You've got to be a goofball outfit to take stage names like Taxi, Tables, Text, Time, and Trial, and then not really make much of an effort to hide your real names either. And you've got to be hardworking to take such care to record the delicate harmonies on the most recent of the band's three albums, Easy Beat, to design such a pretty, intricate CD package, and to tour so relentlessly all around the country. A lot of the time, these guys sound laid back, but that's part of the strategy. Charm whose wryness and wit sneaks up on you.
Dr. Dog is a band of knowing primitives. Guitar notes bend and quaver off tune,
only to reverberate back to a strong melody. The singing of Scott McMicken alternates between a moan and a growl. The lyrics approximate non sequiturs that would do the poet John Ashbery proud. Two of my favorites are the lines, "Cold shoulders have run out of luck," and "Where are you going crazy?" They're buried in this ode to the inability to make oneself understood called Say Something. This album, Easy Beat, is barely more than a half hour long, but it presents an entire worldview. Easygoing, cockeyed optimism with a melancholy streak. A vivid belief that making tuneful music is a virtue in itself. It reminds me of something the artist and film critic Manny Farber wrote, describing his own critical method. I'll substitute the words music for movies here. Quote, "Burrowing into the music, which includes extending the piece, collaging with pace changes, multiple tones, getting different voices into it," unquote. Yep, that's what Dr. Dog sounds like.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Easy Beat by the band Dr. Dog. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
It's an easy beat of nothing, and we don't need no guitars. We can only sing and wreck our cars. Be careful of the judging side. His gavel and his sands collide.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from V2 Records, presenting the White Stripes' new CD, Get Behind Me, Satan, available at Barnes & Noble and barnesandnoble.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a news show that may or may not present the facts. We talk with Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. There's a new DVD set of Indecision 2004, The Daily Show's coverage of last year's presidential elections. Join us for the next Fresh Air.